9:08 on this Friday morning, the 5th of October, 2007. Well, the fact that it's Friday morning and it's after 8 o'clock, that means that it must be time for the Week in Review. Each week, we invite a guest from the left and the right, one each, to come in and talk about the stories of the week. And joining us this morning, both by telephone, we have Ruth Conniff, political editor for the Progressive magazine. Good morning, Ruth. And Owen Robinson, conservative blogger for the website bootsandsabers.com and a columnist for the West Bend Daily News. Good morning, Owen.
Good morning. And good morning, Ruth.
Morning.
Okay, lots to get to this morning. We're going to start with state news first. And, of course, the story in state news for the last several weeks has been the state budget or the lack of one. And that story continues to unfold as the days go by, and we still don't have a budget. Yesterday, Governor Doyle met with the Democratic caucus and warned that property taxes go up, health care costs could rise, and public safety could be in trouble without a new budget. Meanwhile, Assembly Speaker Mike Hipch continues to call for the Senate to pass the education bill that the Assembly passed and deal with that part first and then deal with the rest of the budget later. Let's start with you, Owen, on the state budget. What's your take?
Well, I think in a macro sense that this is a very healthy debate for Wisconsin to have. What we see in the legislative debate is really two polar opposites on where the government of Wisconsin should be, how expensive it should be, how expansive it should be. On the one side, you have the Democrats who are arguing that we need socialized medicine, a doubling of the taxes that Wisconsinites pay, and the largest expansion of Wisconsin government in history. On the other side, you have the Republicans actually saying that there should be a zero tax increase in the budget because Wisconsinites are already overtaxed and overburdened by their government and should have some relief for that. So it's obviously dragging on quite a while. It's not the perfect solution, but on the other hand, our Wisconsin forefathers were smart enough to put in provisions to allow the budget to the previous budget to continue. So the schools continue to operate, roads continue to be repaired, prisoners are still locked up, and we can have this debate amongst ourselves about where we should be as a state without having to hamper the normal operations of Wisconsin.
Ruth?
Well, to say on the one hand, on the other hand, I think, to say that the two sides are sort of equally at loggerheads here is to misrepresent it. Here's Doyle, Governor Doyle, saying both sides should compromise. The thing that the Republicans have been hammering on, very much like President Bush and his veto of the Children's Health Insurance Program this week, nationally, saying socialized medicine, oh my God, that's already been compromised by the state Democrats. They're not going for universal health care. That was a major hang-up in the budget debate. So that's gone. And, so what we have really, I think, are people who think that the state ought to have a budget and people who are following sort of the Newt Gingrich-esque line of saying, hey, why don't we throw the whole thing out altogether? Why don't we let the state grind to a halt? It's really quite radical what the Republicans are doing. And I think amazing in some ways that the Republican state party chair, for example, talks about being proud of the budget debacle. It's outrageous. It's embarrassing that this has gone on for 13 weeks, that our state is the only one in the country that doesn't have a budget yet. It's a bad situation. And I think that Doyle ought to stand up and point to some of the really radical proposals, like one that Owen backs, that would cut, to smithereens the funding for Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television, for example, and just that lets this process drag on so that the schools are going to be in crisis, so that students don't know what their tuition is going to be. You have the Board of Regents talking about what a disaster this is going to be for the UW. We really are in a crisis mode here, and I think that the Republicans are ultimately going to lose the same way that Newt Gingrich lost with the government shutdown, because people don't like it. They don't like to see a state that can't get its business done.
Well, and Ruth, I think that, you say that I mischaracterize it, and I think you do a little bit of that yourself. I think if you're looking at, you know, you speak of it as a crisis, but this isn't like the Gingrich issue back in the 90s. When the federal government doesn't pass a budget, there is no money. The federal budget shuts down. When Wisconsin doesn't pass a budget, we operate under last year's budget. The only crisis is that there are government, there are pieces of government out there who want more money, and they don't want to operate on the last budget's numbers, so they are in a tizzy. But go talk to your average Wisconsinite out there, and you know, many of them didn't receive a raise last year. Many of them are operating under the same amount of money they had last year, and they have to prioritize. They have to decide what's important, what's not important, and prioritize their spending. And all the Republicans are doing is asking the state government to do the same thing.
Well, I think what they're doing is failing to get a plan passed that gets the state government to do any kind of prioritizing or any kind of planning for the future. And the effect of that in the short term is that we don't know what kind of funding is going to be available for any of the basic services that people, average citizens, count on. So, for example, you know, the schools are getting increasingly agitated about how do we know what we can afford and looking at raising local property taxes so that locally people are going to pay taxes to cover this stuff when the state isn't stepping in to cover its piece. I mean, there's not, the idea that you can just not have a budget and then we don't have any more taxes, you're really living in la-la land. You know, ultimately, someone's got to pay for this stuff.
We do have a budget, and we are being taxed. And the schools know how much money, for sure, they will have for this year. The difference is they want to spend more money that they don't have at this point. That's the only crisis here. They have the exact same amount of money that they had last year from the state, and they can budget accordingly, much like Wisconsin's families have to do.
Well, I mean, this is not going to move them through the year. It's just not. I mean, this is the whole way we've set up education financing in the state, of course, is that we continue to run into these crises, and we go to referendum, and we work this thing out in this kind of stopgap way that has been a disaster both for taxpayers and for the school.
The issues surrounding the budget. Governor Doyle made his budget proposal back in January. He said, this is what I want. It went to the Joint Finance Committee, which did its thing and came up with a bill that went to the Senate. Then they completely rewrote it, and then it went to the Assembly. They completely rewrote it. Everybody knew that these arguments were going to come up. And they had from January until July to get this thing done. I think some people in Wisconsin, and this isn't a Democrat-Republican thing, this is just legislators get paid to have a budget done by July 1st. Forget about whether the government shuts down or not. The people that are doing the work get paid to produce a budget by July 1st. Now, I don't know about you, but Wisconsin Public Radio doesn't shut down if I don't get my work done on time, but I can tell you that my supervisor wouldn't be very happy with me if I had a deadline to meet and didn't make it and said, well, you know, you can just use the work I did last week, and that'll be good enough until I get around to finishing it. And then that goes to the next story, which I want to move to, and that is now that the horse has escaped the barn, a number of legislators want to close the barn door. And here's a story about proposed fixes to get these budgets done on time. This is from the Associated Press. Lawmakers are coming up with proposals that would force themselves to pass the state budget in time. If only someone had thought of that 6 months or a year ago. The Bipartisan Conference Committee didn't help matters much, and now legislative leaders are in their second week of secret meetings with the governor's staff, and also a few results to report in their efforts to reach a compromise. Republican Representative Dean Cofford of Neenah and Democratic Representative Lewis Malepsky of Stevens Point would withhold the pay of lawmakers from the due date until they pass the budget. Another proposal made by the Democrats would force members of the conference committee to meet every day or face arrest by the police. There seems to be a sense of frustration over the fact that there isn't a budget. And forget about what the issues are. The job was to get one done by a certain date, and it hasn't happened, and people are not happy about that. This time, let's start with Ruth.
Well, if I were a writer for The Daily Show, I would be calling these press clips about Wisconsin, right? I mean, we're the only state that's got this kind of thing going on. And for the Democrats to suggest arresting lawmakers to get the budget passed, it's embarrassing. We're being embarrassed in front of the nation.
Owen?
Well, I think what we see is, you know, first, you know, you mentioned a few things there. The first is whether or not it is the legislator's job to pass a budget by July 1st, and whether that is, you know, whether that is their job. I'm of the opinion that legislators are there to represent their constituents and act in what they think are in the best interests of the state. And if that means delaying the budget until we can come up with a good budget rather than just passing any budget by an artificial deadline, then I think they are doing their jobs. And the fact that Democrats want to criminalize not passing a budget or arrest lawmakers for not going to the table or whatever that may be, I think shows a degree of desperation that they see that they're under pressure to get a budget passed and they're frustrated and they want to find some way to really artificially move the process forward. But again, I think Wisconsinites are owed this serious debate about where we want our state to be. And at the end of the day, if the voters are not happy with what their legislators have done and how they have represented them in the budget process, we have a process for that. It's called elections, and they can be ousted from office.
We're at a time to take a break. We'll do that, and then when we come back, we have some calls on these state issues and some other stuff to get to, so stick around. I'm John Munson, in for Joy Cardine. This is the Week in Review on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 22 minutes after 8 o'clock, you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Well, here's what's coming up later today. After 10 o'clock this morning, Kathleen Dunn talks with historian Jeffrey Ward, who wrote the book and the script for the PBS film series The War, which tells the stories of those who experienced and helped win World War II. That's after 10 this morning, coming up here on the Ideas Network. This hour, it's the Week in Review, where we take a look at the news of the week and examine it from political perspectives, both left and right. We have Ruth Conniff, political editor of the Progressive magazine, and Owen Robinson, conservative blogger for the website bootsandsabers.com and a columnist for the West Bend Daily News. They join us by telephone. Joining us by telephone also is Don from Manitowoc. Let's take a call from Don. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I have 2 points I would like to make. First of all, on the stalling of the state budget, Republicans are saying that they don't want to have runaway budgets, yet when we had a Republican governor, Tommy Thompson, and a Republican legislature, they left us with a $2.8 billion deficit when our state constitution forbids deficits. So it's a little disingenuous for the Republicans to come along and say that they are fiscally conservative. My second point with regard to health insurance, excuse me, the state law is that if you have an indigent patient needing medical care who falls through the safety network of the federal government, then it falls on the counties to pick up that indigent person's medical care. So when we're talking about the cost of health insurance for the state, I'm wondering, and I don't have an answer to this, but I'm wondering, you know, is it possible that with relieving this from property taxpayers on their county tax bill, that in fact having a statewide health insurance plan for poor people would in fact save us money and not cost us money? So those are my 2 comments. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Don. Owen, why don't you take this one first?
Sure. Well, on Don's first point, I will be no defender of Tommy Thompson and past legislatures' rampant spending. And this goes for the federal government, too, when the Republicans had both of the lawmaking branches of the government and continued to spend like drunken sailors, if that wouldn't give drunken sailors a bad name. I'm certainly not going to defend that. But I don't think that we can use that as some sort of excuse to allow that in the future. You know, we get caught in that circle of justification where we're saying, well, we did it in the past, so we should do it in the future. I think that's the wrong way to think about it. I think what we see with these Republicans in this legislature is a very serious commitment to fiscal restraint and fiscal responsibility. Are there some politics involved with it because there happens to be a Democrat on the other side of the table? Certainly. I don't think we can deny that. Government is all about politics because that's how they get into office. However, I think that many of the people within the Republican caucus and really the fiscally conservative wing of that caucus is in the ascendancy, and I think that they're very serious about passing a fiscally responsible budget for the citizens of Wisconsin.
I would say that they need to show a little more seriousness about this purpose of passing the budget at all. And I think the caller gets to the fundamental point, which is the shell game of this kind of grandstanding about budgets. We won't even have a budget. Let's burn the government. It doesn't get anything done, and ultimately it doesn't save the taxpayers any money. I mean, we talked about education. We're about to pass the October 15th deadline for the state to tell local schools how much state aid they'll get. And if they don't make that deadline, there's going to be an increase to local property taxes by up to $80 million. So the local taxpayer is not going to save money on holding out on passing the budget. And then you get to the issue of health care, which is sort of, it's a perfect example of being penny wise and pound foolish. If we don't pay for preventive care, which this state under Governor Thompson actually did a good job of with Badger Care, if we don't pay for getting kids into doctor's offices to do basic preventive screening, covering adults who fall through the cracks like Badger Care does, then we end up paying for people to go to the emergency room for care, which is much more expensive. So healthcare is a good example of how some planning and some sensible priorities in terms of covering people's basic needs actually saves money down the road. And what you see now nationally is, if you watched on C-SPAN the whole debate about the president's veto of children's health insurance, Republicans nationally are standing up and pointing to Wisconsin as an example of one of the handful of states that actually uses this children's health care money to cover adults. Well, of course, this is a Republican plan. It's a block grant program, and it's been very successful. But to point to that with outrage is really to be dishonest about how these programs save money and how they deal with the healthcare crisis in this country in a way that ultimately, covers people's basic needs and with some planning and some foresight, stays within a reasonable budget.
I agree with you, Ruth, that I think passing a budget, tomorrow would be a great thing. And if the Democrats would stop demanding, massive tax increases, we could get there. But you talk about the taxpayers saving money. If the budget doesn't pass, yes, it's very likely that some property taxpayers out there are going to face a tax increase to fund increases in school spending, keeping in mind that those are local decisions. Individual school districts can choose a budget that doesn't increase spending and doesn't require property tax increases. So it's not going to hit all taxpayers. But at the same time, even at the $80 million estimate, if that truly does come to pass, keep in mind that the state budget that the Democrats proposed, even if you take out Healthy Wisconsin, includes nearly $3 billion in tax increases. And as a taxpayer, I'm pretty satisfied with turning away a $3 billion tax increase for the cost of an $80 million tax increase. That's a good deal in my book.
Well, but that's just one area. That's disingenuous. I mean, that's one area. There are many other areas where it's going to ultimately cost us money not to have a state budget. And I think, you've got to look at, are people paying now? Are they paying later? I mean, this is the story of the Thompson administration, what the caller was referring to with, this shell game about property tax relief that never came. I mean, it's just, if the state doesn't cover it, then it's pushed down to the municipal level. And, the same thing at the federal level with the unfunded mandates for the state. I mean, it's dishonest to continuously say, well, if we just don't pay for this stuff, somehow it'll go away. The burden falls more and more heavily on the more and more local level.
The problem with that that rhetoric is it's based on a mindset that spending and taxes must go up. They don't. There is plenty of things in government that can be cut back, that can be cut altogether to actually reduce the size of government. There was a time when, states functioned with a much smaller percentage of the state's gross product than they do today. And I don't see why, and those times can't be why they're invalidated, why we have to, every single year, taxes must go up, spending must go up. I completely reject that mindset.
Well, I mean, if you take an individual example and you look at it, you have to look at, you know, what is this costing us, and are we spending our money wisely? I think there are some basic items that we can all agree on, and I think if the legislature could sit down and deal with it honestly, then we would agree. You know, fuel prices have increased dramatically. My daughter's class in first grade at a Madison public school can't take field trips anymore. They can't afford the bus. I mean, I think, you know, for people who have their kids in the schools where they're facing massive cutbacks every year, it's pretty obvious that they need to spend some more money to maintain the same level of service. There are many, many, many little individual examples like that. You know, you gotta have a legislature with the honesty to sit down and really look at it on a case-by-case basis. And then you gotta look at what the Republicans in our legislature are asking for. And I know, you know, you're on the side of the folks who want to make some very deep cuts, and cuts that could ultimately eliminate things like Wisconsin Public Radio. You know, that Grover Norquist and his national tax group has organized this rally, and maybe you want to talk about that, you know, that is going to get together a group of people who really want to make some radical change to what kind of services and what kind of, you know, commonwealth we have in the state of Wisconsin.
Well, first, there has never been a massive cut in school spending in Wisconsin. There have been years when it didn't go up as others would have liked, but there has never been an actual dollar cut in K-12 spending. So that's a little bit false. But as far as the other thing, how is it a radical change to say, let's operate the state on the same amount of money we had last year? And it's not even the same amount of money. You're talking about the same tax rate. At those tax rates, given the normal growth of the economy in Wisconsin, the state is projected to see over $1 billion in increased revenue in the next budget cycle. That's over $1 billion more money that they can spend without raising taxes. As a Wisconsin taxpayer, I got to say, that seems like enough money to me, and that I don't see why, if we make good quality reasoned decisions about how we prioritize and how we spend in this state, that we can't operate the budget on the same tax rates as we had in the previous budget cycle.
Let's move on a little bit, because we've got callers waiting to join us, and we've got a lot of other issues that we want to get to, including some important national issues. I want to take a moment to re-identify the program and our guests so people will know who's saying what. I'm John Bunsen. I'm the guy that sits here and doesn't say very much at all during this hour, which makes it easy for me. Sitting in for Joy Cardine here on the Ideas Network, and joining me for the Week in Review, Ruth Conniff, political editor of the Progressive magazine, and Owen Robinson, conservative blogger for the website bootsandsabers.com and a columnist for the West Bend Daily News. Well, I think we've mined the state news for about everything we can get out of it. Let's shift to some national stories. The CEO of Blackwater, a private contractor in Iraq, was grilled pretty severely by an oversight committee in the U.S. House of Representatives this past week. Now some legislators want to make all contractors in Iraq subject to prosecution by U.S. courts. And in fact, the House passed legislation saying expressly that this past week. And I'll start with you, Ruth.
Well, this has just been an unbelievable unfolding story, the story of Blackwater. And Eric Prince, obviously, after being a very secretive figure, appeared publicly and accepted no responsibility, essentially said, you know, mistakes were made. I think that the new legislation, it gets to the heart of the matter, which is the impunity of this private mercenary force that is paid five times what U.S. troops are paid to operate, you know, in this lawless atmosphere. At least these folks should be subject to U.S. law, and I think that it's definitely a step in the right direction to try to impose that. Unfortunately, it's not going to be imposed retroactively, so the law that they're entertaining is not going to apply to the atrocity that we saw with Blackwater already, so that's a problem. And then there's also the possibility that you can argue that Blackwater is not a contractor in the sense that's defined in the law, so I'm not sure that it's going to have a specific effect of holding the individuals accountable for the killings of the Iraqi civilians that shocked the country in the last couple of weeks. But it's just dealing directly with the impunity of these private contractors in Iraq is very important.
Owen?
Well, I think that this is a case where hard cases may make some bad law, and we need to tread carefully. I mean, clearly, if Blackwater has committed some of the acts they've been accused of, they are horrific, and they should be condemned and, you know, cut out of their relationship with the U.S. military. At the same time, you're talking about private U.S. citizens operating in a foreign land. Now, Blackwater does serve as a contractor on occasion for the U.S. military, and in that regard, the U.S. military and the U.S. government share some responsibility for their actions because they're acting on behalf of the United States. On the other hand, there are Blackwater agents who are hired by private individuals and by the Iraqi government and by other people over there who would like to use their services. And in that regard, they're operating in a foreign land. They're not under U.S. jurisdiction. And I think we run into some cautious areas if we're going to hold U.S. citizens who are operating in foreign lands by the laws that only apply within the jurisdiction of the United States boundaries. So unless you're willing to declare Iraq a protectorate or part of the United States, I don't see how we can extend jurisdiction over there.
One of our listeners sent in a message that says the CEO of Blackwater is married to the sister of Jeb Bush's wife, so it's all in the family.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. I think there's a definite case of nepotism here. Eric Prince he's a far right, he's a Gary Bauer intern, excuse me, and his company, like Enron, didn't exist 10 years ago, and now it's making scads of money. You know, it's really privatization gone amok, and it's typical of the Bush administration that you see this crony firm that's behaving disastrously with impunity, and in this case, committing murder. I mean, it really shines a light on everything that's wrong with this administration and how it's executing policy.
Wow, nepotism in government. Never heard of such a thing. I don't think that that's a feature that's unique to the Bush administration. And it's interesting that you throw in the Enron issue, because Enron was actually a company, and all of the crimes committed actually happened under the Clinton administration. So unless you want to somehow claim that Bush was president during that administration, I don't see how you can latch Enron to it.
Well, you know, yes, the Bush administration did not invent cronyism, but they really, you know, they've refined it to a high art. And the impunity part of it, the number of people connected with the Bush administration who are under investigation, and the amount of the way in which the Bush administration and its officials have found new ways to exploit catastrophe abroad and at home for cash is really, it's impressive.
Let's take a call from Tina in Sparta. Tina, good morning. Thanks for calling us.
Good morning. I'm a retired veteran, and it absolutely sickens me that we hire mercs. There's no private, corporate. We're hiring mercs. When did the Marines and when did the Army quit guarding the interest of the United States and we start hiring whores to work for us?
I think that's absolutely right. The idea that the United States is hiring these mercenaries, it turns out a seventh of whom have been dismissed from Blackwater for improper conduct, and then passing laws that protect them from prosecution, it goes against everything our country is supposed to stand for. And by the way, I mean, the idea that U.S. law can't cover these people, as Owen suggested, is ridiculous. I mean, we hold our service members to a much higher standard. We can come up with a way to hold these guys accountable, having already passed a law saying, no, we're not going to let the Iraqis hold them accountable. We want the Iraqis to have sovereignty, but we're introducing these mercenaries into their country who are murdering people and then saying that they can't be held accountable in Iraqi courts. Well, then it is up to the United States to hold them accountable.
Well, and that's just it. I think if they have committed crimes in Iraq, then it is the Iraqi courts that should hold them accountable. Much like if you are caught speeding in Germany, well, Germany's not a good example. We'll use England. If you get caught speeding in England, you will go through their court system to take care of the crime you committed in their country. It's a matter of jurisdiction. It's not a matter of accountability. As far as the issue of mercenaries, the use of private forces or other foreign forces or mercenaries in warfare goes back as long as warfare has. And even if you look at other wars the U.S. has operated in, we always engage both local forces and other forces to help out. And unless you're willing to put U.S. Marines and U.S. soldiers guarding, for instance, high-profile private citizens in Iraq and put our soldiers' lives on the risk for that, then I would suggest that perhaps mercenaries are the best way. I know it leaves a bad taste in some people's mouths, but really at the end of the day, the goal of the U.S. military is to accomplish the mission and with whatever forces are necessary to accomplish it.
Let's move on to another issue here. Once again, the White House finds itself denying a torture assertion. The official position of the White House remains the same. We do not torture. The administration is denying reports that a secret Justice Department opinion in 2005 cleared the way for the return of painful interrogation tactics, or that it superseded U.S. anti-torture law. The New York Times says that under the leadership of Alberto Gonzalez, who was then Attorney General, the department issued a secret opinion allowing the use of painful physical and psychological tactics against terror suspects. And those tactics, the report says, included simulated drownings and freezing temperatures. It came a year after an opinion in which justice officials publicly declared torture to be abhorrent, and the administration seemed to back away from saying it had the authority for such practices. A White House spokesman wouldn't comment on whether the 2005 opinion authorized specific practices, but she said it didn't reinterpret the law. So that's back in the news, and let's start with Owen this time.
Well, clearly if the Bush administration is saying one thing in public and issuing private policies that contradict those public statements, then they should be held accountable. That's obviously not acceptable. Whether or not the memo is valid or whether it is something that constitutes torture or whether it's something, whether we do need to be torturing, which I personally don't think we do need to be, is a public debate that perhaps we should have or are continuing to have. But as far as, I can't make apologies or make excuses for the Bush administration contradicting themselves. It's happened before. I'm sure it'll happen again. And I think they're being held out for condemnation, and that's appropriate.
Well, we've had the debate, and Congress passed a law. So the Bush administration, much to the umbrage of Republicans and Democrats in Congress, has just gone ahead with this policy that that is illegal. It's illegal internationally. It's illegal here. It goes to the issue of checks and balances. The Supreme Court and Congress have both held these practices to be against the law. So, the Bush administration clearly sees itself as a one branch government that can go ahead and do these things that are both abhorrent and illegal. And it just raises the question of who are we? This is not how Americans see ourselves. And it's appalling. And within the Justice Department, there was a faction of people who were making that point, and the Bush administration essentially purged them when it brought in Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez, and they got unanimity of opinion that they can do whatever they want. And they dealt with the public relations problem by coming out and saying that they were against torture, and then privately issued these memos. Part of the problem that they face is that they don't want to see prosecution of the people who have already committed these acts, and so there's a very complicated legal effort to thread the needle and say we're against torture, but these increasingly rough tactics don't really amount to torture. And it's reached the level of the absurd, because again and again the practices have been defined so specifically and clearly as torture that they really can't make that case. So now you see somebody like Fran Townsend, Bush's Homeland Security Advisor, coming out and making these statements that, we don't torture, I can't comment on the contents of the memo. They don't deny that the memo exists and that these practices are taking place. But then they take issue with whether it matters how we treat detainees, because of how U.S. service people can expect to be treated if they're detainees, and they say, well, it doesn't matter. And that's a fundamental point that John McCain has made. We can't go out in the world and torture people and then, you know, really make a case that our own people shouldn't be tortured. So it goes to the safety of U.S. service people, and it goes to just such a basic moral question. It's really revolting to Americans to see this. And there's a lot of evidence that doesn't work, that you threaten to torture people, they'll say anything to get out of that situation. And so the intelligence isn't even any good.
Well, we need to take a break because we're a little late on that. When we come back, we'll take some more phone calls. 800-642-1234 is a toll-free number you can use. And in Madison, please call us at 263-1890. We'll be right back. I'm John Munson. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8:46. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine. Joy will be back on Monday. Well, here's what's coming later on the Ideas Network. And after 4, it's time for your views on the news. Call in with the story that got your attention this week. Ben Marins and his guest Mordecai Lee will take your calls. And it's always a lively discussion, just like the one we're having this hour, which, of course, is the Week in Review. We do this every Friday morning at 8 o'clock. And we have with us Owen Robinson, conservative blogger for the website bootsandsabers.com and a columnist for the West Bend Daily News, and Ruth Conniff, political editor of the Progressive magazine. Owen, I didn't mean to cut you off there at the break, but we were running kind of late. I needed to take care of the bookkeeping here. You were about to say something. Why don't you go ahead and make your comment, and then I want to go to a phone call.
Okay, I was just going to mention that the debate regarding, when we discuss torture, regarding how our soldiers are going to be treated abroad versus if they're captured in the event, you know, compared with how we treat the prisoners when we capture them, is kind of a moot point in the age of terrorism. I mean, that applied when we were dealing with warring against nation states, where there were some relevant standards, I guess, regarding warfare. But, you know, when our soldiers are captured, they're dragged through the streets and beheaded. I don't think that that's going to change if we decide to coddle the people that we capture. But I do agree with Ruth that, you know, the benefits of torture have long since been discounted quite a bit, and how much information you can actually get from torturing someone. I recall a book I read recently about Stalin, and he used to joke about how he could get people to confess to anything he liked. And so, you know, it's brutality doesn't always bring the results that perhaps we would like.
Let's go to a phone call. We'll take one from Dave in Wanakee. Dave, good morning. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm going to bring up a different subject. There was vote in Congress this week in which and to provide money for S-CHIP, and the president vetoed it. And by their recent votes to provide a supplemental $200 billion for the war in Iraq and supporting the president's veto of the S-CHIP funding to provide health care to the poor children, Republicans show that they're willing to spend our treasure to kill Iraqis, but they won't spend a dime to save poor American children.
Well, we were going to raise the S-CHIP issue a little bit later in the program, but we may as well go to it now. S-CHIP funding was passed by both houses of Congress, and President Bush vetoed it. Now it has to go back to Congress to see if there can be enough votes put together to override the president's veto. Ruth, why don't you start on this one?
Well, the caller's absolutely right. We're spending $3 billion a week in Iraq, and look at all the good we're doing there. You know, 3 or 4 months of the Iraq War would cover this, you know, this health care for poor kids. The Bush administration is really on the wrong side of history on this one. You know, Bush looks like a walk-on in Michael Moore's Sicko when he stands there and talks about socialized medicine. You know, S-CHIP is not socialized medicine. It is a Republican approved program. It was a bipartisan effort during the Clinton administration. And as I said earlier in the show, Wisconsin has been a shining example of how effective and popular this program is. Tommy Thompson talks about Badger Care every chance he gets, and for good reason. It's a block grant. It's devolution, which the Republicans are supposed to like. Now they're picking on individual states that have managed to expand the program or combine it with other funds to expand coverage as if this were an example of something nefarious. You know, God forbid that we should cover not just kids at the poverty level or 200% of the poverty level, but also 300% of the poverty level. Well, you know, we look at the example here in Wisconsin. The reason that we use the funds the way we do here is because of welfare reform, and it was part of the effort to bridge the gap between Medicaid and employer health insurance for the working poor, and to get adults covered and their children has been really successful in Wisconsin. It's gotten people in for preventive care. It's saved money on emergency room visits, and, you know, it's a very effective program. I think Bush really looks bad when he stands up in front of the country and opposes something that is just such so fundamentally both effective and needed. And you know, who can argue with health care for poor children?
Well, there are a number of items there. First, the argument that we're willing to spend money on a war, on the military versus health care for kids is really the classic guns versus butter debate, and it's one that we can certainly have, but I think we should all recognize that you know, how we prioritize our budget spending has to do with our national interests and how we're the people who made those decisions were duly elected by the people of the United States. So to sit here and argue that, gosh, if we weren't in Iraq, we could have health care for all the kids, well, from a financial sense, maybe, but then there are consequences to those actions as well. And I suppose I should step aside from the fact that I still, to this day, can't find the article in the Constitution that authorizes this kind of spending by the federal government, but I suppose that horse has left the barn. The issue with this particular program, and it's one that the Democrats are loving because they can jump out and it's for the kids. It's for the children. Of course we should spend more money. After all, it's for the children. How can you argue with that, you cruel, heartless person? But in reality, this program is rather poorly structured, and really the Republicans who helped pass it years ago have much of the blame for this. But it's poorly structured, and as we pour money into it, we're not fixing the structure of it. What it really amounts to is an unfunded liability that's going to come due several years from now, that we're going to have all this spending that we've committed to that there's no money there to pay for. So when you continue with that, if you want to dump more money into it without restructuring it, what you're guaranteeing yourself is a tax increase in several years to help fund the commitments you've already made. That's the cycle that we got into with Social Security and Medicare and all of these other mandates that the federal government has committed to for forever to funding these programs at certain levels, and the money isn't there. We should get to a point that we are actually funding things. We are funding the commitments that we are making to the people of America. And quite frankly, you know, I think, you know, first, what does Bush care if he looks bad standing up in front of the people? He isn't going to be up for re-election, and none of the people running for president are anywhere near him. They're running away from him because of his approval ratings. So I don't think he's concerned with that. And if he had been making these kind of fiscally responsible vetoes all along, I suspect that approval rating would be quite a bit higher.
I have to say, now the conversation has come full circle, right? And, I mean, you can't have it both ways. On the one hand, to say, you know, we shouldn't make any of these commitments because they're unfunded mandates. And on the other hand, to say, you know, as we were talking about at the beginning of the program with the state budget, you know, we can't afford this stuff. I mean, it's really outrageous to, you know, to take a program that does exactly what the Republicans have said they wanted to do, and that is to devolve control to the states, to give some federal money to finance it, and, you know, to want to throw that out, and on the other hand to say, you know, with the state budget that we can't, you know, we can't even commit any money to these programs. I mean, it's just ridiculous. You know, this program has been clearly very successful, as its enormous bipartisan support shows. At some point, we have to look at our priorities and say, as the caller pointed out, you know, is it really, why is it that we can always come up with billions of dollars to spend on something like the disaster in Iraq, and yet we can't manage to cover basic health care for people? And I think our country has reached a point where people really recognize that. They recognize the disaster in our foreign policy and how enormously expensive it is, and what good is it doing us? It's making us less safe. And they recognize the enormous need And people have to honestly take a look at how are we going to provide health insurance for poor kids. I mean, we are the only country in the Western world that doesn't manage to get it together to provide health care to its citizens. And I think this is the issue that's really, it's one of the issues that's driving the presidential election this year.
Again, Ruth, for I believe the fourth time, Wisconsin is funding the programs it has under the budget. The previous budget continues on when a new budget isn't passed. So they are funded. Those programs are being paid for. So, you know, that.
But doesn't that assume that your costs are remaining static? We had an email from one of our listeners who says, "Would someone please ask this conservative blogger guy how, with the cost of gas, food, and books going up, costs of education aren't rising, and therefore the schools don't need more money just to stay in place?"
Exactly.
And the same thing for the rest of everything else the state does, from monitoring fish virus to cleaning the floors in the Capitol building.
Well, you know, the cost of my fuel has gone up this year. So has the cost of books. So has the cost of running my lawnmower to mow my lawn. And what I don't get to go to my boss and demand that he pay for the increases in my expenses.
You don't get a cost of living increase.
I have to prioritize my spending and decide how I'm going to manage my budget. And that's all the citizens of Wisconsin are asking the state of Wisconsin to do. We have given you money. We have given you lots of money, and in some areas, way too much money. And all we're doing is saying, you know,
that we can't pass a budget unlike every other state in the nation. I mean, come on. You can't hold out that that's a responsible position. We can't pass a budget. We're the only state that can't do it. All we're asking for is some accountability. I mean, the legislators are the ones who need to show some accountability and get their job done.
Wisconsin has a long legacy of doing things that other states don't do, and it's often called leadership. And the fact that people here in Wisconsin are having a serious debate about the size and scope of our government and are willing to put their reputations and their electoral futures and their minds on the line to discuss this issue and have a very serious debate, and to flippantly say that we should pass a budget just to pass a budget because everybody else has. Well, by God, if every other state jumped off a bridge, would we do the same thing?
Passing a budget and jumping off a bridge don't seem to me to be such analogous.
If a budget includes a doubling of the tax burden in Wisconsin, we might as well jump off a bridge.
Okay.
Or maybe have it fall down underneath us. You never know how that's going to work. We're just about out of time, and I don't want to bring up another topic because we don't really have a chance to get into it. So how about a quick quiz? Yes or no, Dave Obey proposing a surtax to support the war. Bad idea, good idea. Owen, two words on this, yes or no?
Well, I can't say yes and no, so I will say no. Bad idea,
okay.
And it won't pass.
All right, Ruth Conniff?
Yes, we got to take a look at what this thing is costing us, and we got to be serious about paying for it if we're going to go on and do it.
Okay, we're going to leave it there. Thank you both for an energetic and enjoyable hour. Appreciated your being here.
Thank you, John.
Ruth Conniff, political editor of the Progressive magazine, and Owen Robinson, conservative blogger for the website bootsandsabers.com and a columnist for the West Bend Daily News, joining us today by phone on The Week in Review, which was produced by Leo Duran and Karen Prager, with on-air production by Karen Prager. I'm John Munson, sitting in for Joy Cardine, who will be back on Monday. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.